This was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened. You know, we have a basic responsibility to protect people's data, and if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people. So our responsibility now is to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And there are a few basic things that I think we need to do to ensure that. One is making sure that developers like Alexander Kogan, who got access to a lot of information and then improperly used it, just don't get access to as much information going forward.
Facebook co-founder Mark Zuckerberg on CNN last month apologizing for how his company handled the Cambridge Analytica scandal. As many as 87 million users had their data collected without their permission. We'll get a chance to hear Zuckerberg's apologies again tomorrow and Wednesday when he testifies on Capitol Hill. Russia, Cambridge Analytica, privacy, the focus. To give a little context to these hearings, we want to look at how Facebook has grown since it launched in 2004 and where it might be headed, including what it could look like with some federal regulation. Elizabeth Dwoskin is Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. She's based in San Francisco. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Well, great, thanks. Well, Mark Zuckerberg takes great offense when people say, oh, the Facebook user is the product that he's just selling people to advertisers. And he says it's really about community and giving people a voice. Is that really how Facebook sees itself?
I think it's how they see themselves, sure. But they're a very mission-driven company. And Mark Zuckerberg is the most idealistic of them all. But it doesn't mean that that's actually what's happening. He always makes a distinction. He always says, for years, he's been saying, people don't seem to get that we just don't sell your data. And that is literally true in the sense that anything you share on Facebook, they're not selling it. As he says, it's actually counter to their business model to do that. What they want is to keep it for themselves, make inferences about you from it, and then sell those inferences as audiences to advertisers that can then target you on Facebook and across the web.
Well, isn't that a distinction with not much of a difference? I mean, you're...
Well,
yeah.
I mean, that's how I've always felt covering it. But, I mean, they really hone it in, but they don't talk about their own role as much.
Okay. The company's worth, what, $450 billion?
Yep, thereabouts.
That's not a small amount. How is it that it's the only company doing this, or pretty much the only company doing this? Why? How is it able to shut out the competition?
The only social network or the only company
targeted
advertising?
I guess to do it in this manner, to be so ingrained in the lives of people across the globe.
Well, you know, one thing is I would contrast it to Google and compare. It's always interesting. Google, you know, doesn't care as much about, well, they probably do, but they don't know as much about, you know, the foods you like to eat and this and that, even though they have all the information from your browsing habits if you use Chrome. But they've created products that are embedded in your lives in a really seamless kind of way. Like, no one says, I'm going to delete Gmail these days or Google Docs.
Mm-hmm.
They've Google Maps. They've created a lot of ubiquitous products that would even be hard to let go of. What's interesting about Facebook is that Facebook is ubiquitous, but I would say as ubiquitous as the internet itself, which is what Mark Zuckerberg wants. But he doesn't just want Facebook to be ubiquitous. He really wants Facebook to be loved, and he himself wants to be loved. And so I think that's different from Google, which kind of seeks to make products that are, you know, addictively good. They're just so useful. But Mark Zuckerberg wants you to sort of love Facebook in a different way. In 2014, he actually recreated a motto called Ship Love. And literally every team in the company had to come up with a way to, quote, ship love because it was a company motto. So there's a lot of kind of frou-frou idealism going on.
What does that mean, ship love?
Well, I always wondered that, too. But I think what they were trying to say was, you know, people need to feel like they really, really like the features that we're giving. We're not just putting out, you know, technology tools that nobody notices. We want them to be things that people really, really like. And this is about connecting people. So there's this whole kind of positive spin on connection, which you see in Mark's personality and throughout Facebook's history, and it leads to one of the problems that the major problems we're seeing today, which is all the blind spots, which is that when people don't connect, they don't always ship love. They don't always connect positively. And the company and Mark personally has had a really hard time seeing that.
Well, I guess, you know, how much of that do you believe? Do you believe that he is sincere when he says that? Or is that just, again, part of the marketing that when you get people to ship love, you get them to be more connected to the company? Therefore, you know, that's more valuable for advertisers.
I think all the elements are there. I think one of the things Mark has done is that even though he's the CEO, most people recognize that Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer, is actually a co-CEO. And she takes care of the ad business, the day-to-day, the dealings with lawmakers, the policies. I would say that the stuff, you know, that's in the present, whereas Mark has been focused very much on buying Oculus, buying WhatsApp, buying Instagram. You could just say Facebook's future. He was live video was very important to him. He's obsessed with video and the future of video. So I think that, you know, he probably doesn't think, well, maybe he doesn't admit anymore that connecting people means hooking them in. But that was a huge part of their culture. And, you know, the motto for engineers until 2014, as people know, is move fast and break things, which mm-hmm. was a way of saying we'll do anything. We'll break things in order to connect people. And remember, Facebook invented growth hacking. The terms that we have called growth hacking today, that came from Facebook because they had a division called growth. Now, that the head of that division has now become a venture capitalist who's literally seeded companies across the valley with their own growth division. So this was an ethos. It was a culture that spread to all of Silicon Valley.
So how does Facebook grow now?
How does Facebook grow? I mean, they use a lot of still design techniques. You probably get notes in your inbox if you use Facebook every day saying, this is how many friends pinged you. This is how many times you were tagged in this. This is all the messages you got. Like if you notice, you get pinged on all channels. If you have notifications turned on your smartphone, you're going to get them on your smartphone. Another feature that sometimes some people have turned on is live videos start streaming automatically. You'll notice if a video is still, you have to click on it. But if you open a Facebook and the video starts streaming automatically, it's just going to draw you in. So there's a designer named Tristan Harris who used to work for Google but left and has become critical of tech companies. And he says that if you look around these companies' platforms, you'll see all these tiny little subtle psychological features that are designed to hook you in. And Facebook, of course, is totally data-driven, and they're measuring all of that very intensely for years.
Right. And they seem, do you think that they'll get some questions along those lines? I know a lot of parents are concerned with the addictive qualities of social media, primarily Instagram, Snapchat, but these are techniques that Facebook pioneered.
These are techniques Facebook pioneered. And so really, when you talk about Mark Zuckerberg going to testify in Congress this week, we're talking about really a reckoning with the entire Facebook culture that has led to this. And that's why a lot of critics are saying, look, this is really fundamentally their culture. He can talk in very lofty, high-minded language. He's thinking a lot about his legacy, about connecting the world. But if you look at what the company is actually doing, it looks different. And it's connecting the world for the good and the bad. And a lot of people think that's not going to change unless there's a stronger hand. Outsiders, regulators in U.S. and Europe take a stronger hand with the company's practices, particularly around political advertising.
Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how Volkswagen was able to crawl back from a PR fiasco a couple of years ago when it was caught cheating on its diesel emissions. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. For the last few years, every time you heard the name Volkswagen, or nearly every time, it was followed by the words emissions and scandal. The company famously was caught installing software on its diesel cars that cheated on smog tests. And full disclosure here, I, along with many others, 11 million others, that is, fell for the clean diesel line. Now, after $30 billion in fines and a lot of work on the PR front, it appears the German automaker has recovered. It is the world's biggest automaker. Its profits and shares are close to pre-emission scandal levels, and it wants to be a leading maker of electric cars. Matthew Campbell wrote a cover story on all of this for Bloomberg Businessweek. He joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so 2+ years ago, this was terrible for VW. People were saying the car company might not even survive. So take us back 2 years ago and paint a picture of what it looked like for VW at the time.
Well, so what was revealed, and it was sort of one big revelation and then consecutive smaller revelations, was that Volkswagen had been systematically rigging the software on cars so that when they entered a testing environment, they would appear cleaner than they were. Now, this was huge. Volkswagen shares lost something like a third of their value in a couple of days. The longtime chief executive officer of the company was ousted. The trust in the brand completely collapsed. It is really important that we don't forget that, at least in an actuarial sense, this is going to have very serious health consequences. There were emissions put into the atmosphere that should not have been there for years, for millions of cars. And there are scientists at MIT and elsewhere have estimated that those emissions are going to contribute to significant numbers of premature deaths. Mm. There were significantly more pollutants going into the atmosphere than there should have been. And air pollution has serious health effects. So this was a very, very big thing.
And they faced tons of lawsuits and also huge fines, as you mentioned, criminal complaints, shareholder lawsuits, the whole gamut. Those are still being played out?
Yes. Look, the legal side of this is going to go on for years and years. It's going to keep a lot of lawyers very busy and deep into billable hours, considerably into the next decade. So we'll have a long tail. A lot of the claims were settled in the U.S. in particular. In Europe, there are still thousands of investor lawsuits going on. However, this is not going to go away. And if you want a guide for just how long these things can run, the BP oil spill in 2010 in the Gulf of Mexico, that one is still going, and it's very much still going. So you know, and that's eight years on. So VW has a long way to go to putting this completely behind it.
But here in the United States, it appears that a lot of the legal issues have been resolved, and really quickly. How did that happen?
Well, so there was a settlement process that VW entered into voluntarily, and what that did was consolidate the claims of federal and state regulators, California being the most important state regulator, against Volkswagen into one-ish legal proceeding. So obviously there were little tangents to the legal proceeding, but there was one central proceeding, and that allowed there to be a couple of central settlements. So quite early on, Volkswagen established a process for people in the U.S. who had purchased these cars, figured out how many it would have to buy back, how much compensation it would have to pay out. And so that allowed it actually within really a year and a half to begin to put a pretty solid number on what its ultimate costs would be. And that meant, even though those costs were enormous, that it could, of course, plan for the future.
Yeah, interesting detail that part of this process was overseen by Robert Mueller, who was then in private practice.
But believe it or not, he's on to much sexier topics now, I think. But for a while, he was Mr. Volkswagen.
Well, and that plays into it in a way when you talk about sexier topics, because the media lost interest because then Donald Trump became the main story.
That's right. Look, late 2015, without putting too fine a point on it, was a very good time to have revelations of past misbehavior surface, because the attention span of the American media, as you can imagine, was pretty short for anything that didn't start with Donald Trump. So really, Volkswagen was on the front page for a little while, and then bigger stories came along, and then they were able to get through these settlements relatively lightly in terms of the media spotlight.
And also the fact that here in the United States, not a lot of people own these cars.
That's right. I mean, VW has always been something of an also-ran in the U.S., you know, as opposed to in Europe, where if you walk down the street in Paris or in Berlin and count the VW brand cars, I mean, you'll run out of fingers in about a second because they're everywhere. And in the U.S., it's a much more marginal brand, and diesel in the U.S. has been a much more marginal fuel. Diesel for Americans is something you think of for, you know, big rigs or buses, not for passenger cars, whereas in Europe, it very much is something for passenger cars. So this was largely a European problem in terms of the numbers of vehicles, though, because of the nature of the American legal system, VW's costs ended up being much larger in the U.S.
It's still surprising, though, when you hear that VW is the largest automaker in the world. I would assume that it would be Toyota.
It was Toyota. Volkswagen took the crown a couple of years ago and has kept it. It's important to remember, though, that Volkswagen, you know, obviously is the brand Volkswagen, you know, the Beetle and all that, but it's also Audi, it's also Porsche, it's also Skoda, which is a big brand in Europe. So it really is a very, very big machine. It's 12 brands in total, and just selling titanic numbers of cars, particularly these days in China, which is where the growth is, of course.
Okay, and so now it wants to be a leader in the electric car venture. Is it able to do that?
Yes. So what Volkswagen has done to lay out a plan for its future is essentially say, with real money behind it, with credibility, that it wants to be the leading electric car producer in the world, that it wants every one of its cars, 300 some odd models, to be available in an electric version. It wants to essentially secure enormous supplies of batteries, because that's the big choke point, and that it wants to put this industrial expertise that it has to work making electric cars cheap and unremarkable or boring even, you know, as opposed to a Tesla, which is quite glamorous and thus expensive, you know, that a VW electric car will be just normal and will bring electric mobility to the masses, sort of like how the Beetle in post-war Europe for many people was the first car they could afford as a private individual or as a family. So, you know, it's a fairly credible thing for Volkswagen to say, actually, because they, if there's one thing they know, it's building huge numbers of cars. And as we know with Tesla's troubles ramping up production, even if you have fantastic designs, you know, it is an industrial business. It's a business of scale and running factories and moving around supply chains. And that's what Volkswagen knows how to do.
Right. Just describe their factory, their leading factory in the town. I mean, the town was basically built to build cars, right?
Yeah. So Wolfsburg, which is a town sort of in the middle of nowhere in northern Germany, was built by the Nazis. As an automotive city, it is a built from scratch for Volkswagen. When you get off the train there, you know, you just see Volkswagen logos everywhere. It is a city essentially run by Volkswagen. The main factory in Wolfsburg is the size of the Principality of Monaco, which is small for a country, but very big for a factory, as you can imagine. It's almost out of another age. It's sort of this vertically integrated city just for cars. You know, they make their own sausages. They run their own coal power plant. They have their own Volkswagen-run nursery for plants where employees can go pick up flowers. You know, it is really an automotive state within a state. And that's actually something that came up in Germany a lot in the wake of the emissions scandal was discussion of the closeness of Volkswagen historically with the German government. You know, it is arguably, you know, along with Siemens, the most important industrial company in the country, in a country where industrial companies are very important. And so that's something that the German government was criticized for by a lot of people in the political opposition and elsewhere, that Volkswagen had very little daylight with politicians.
Right. So did the German government help it out at its lowest point in the last few years?
Well, Angela Merkel, the chancellor then and the chancellor now and probably the chancellor tomorrow, was quite critical of Volkswagen initially, but she also was supportive of diesel and has consistently supported diesel as a technology, despite this incredible experience that Volkswagen had of revealing that diesel cars were not as clean as they were purported to be. So in terms of stepping in to avoid the destruction of this technology that Volkswagen and it should be said, the other big German automakers, Daimler, which is otherwise known as Mercedes, and BMW, had also put a lot of money into diesel. In terms of stepping in to avoid, to defend that technology, she did help these companies avoid a lot of their investments, a lot of their strategy having to go out the window, because diesel is here to stay, at least for now.
But not clean diesel. Quote unquote clean diesel.
Well, not quote unquote clean diesel. It is cleaner now. The software modifications that Volkswagen has made to these cars, the physical fixes in some cases that it's made, have helped on the emissions front. It's important, though, that we specify there are two kinds of emissions from cars you worry about. One is carbon dioxide, obviously, climate change. The other is nitrogen oxide, or NOx, which is really an issue around smog. So these are different things. Diesel cars tend to perform better on the carbon dioxide side. They are cleaner from that perspective, but they have big problems on the nitrogen oxide side. So the diesel cars were always okay from a carbon perspective. They are now better from a nitrogen oxide perspective, but a lot of governments, particularly in Europe, are now reconsidering whether having so many diesel engines around is desirable, because smog remains a big problem here.
All right. So what's going to happen to all of those cars that were recalled? I mean, there are some pictures going around on Instagram and elsewhere of just vast parking lots filled with these cars, hundreds of thousands of them recalled all over the United States. They're just sitting there. What happens to them?
Well, that's a very good question. I would imagine eventually they get scrapped, though I understand for now some of them are being maintained, though it is worth noting that the number of cars actually recalled in the grand scheme of things was very small. You know, there were 11 million affected cars, 11 million cars that had their software rigged in some way. 8 or 9 million of those were in Europe. In Europe, cars were not recalled. They were fixed. Or rather, they were recalled to be fixed rather than recalled to be taken off the road, if you like. So this is not a problem in Europe where instead of cars sitting in fields waiting for some future fate, they've been returned to their owners with new software, with a physical modification that brings their emissions into compliance. So whatever does happen to these cars in the U.S., while they may seem like an enormous number in photographs, relative to the scale of the number of cars Volkswagen sells, it is a rather small parking lot indeed.
But they're not going to try to offload them to some other country with low emission standards, are they?
I think there would be an awful lot of scrutiny of anything like that. So I very much doubt they would want to do that. And if they did, it would be found out very quickly.
Matthew Campbell is senior reporter for Bloomberg based in London. He co-wrote an article on the cover of a recent issue called Volkswagen's Great Escape, How the World's Largest Automaker Survived Dieselgate. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why the Justice Department is siding with a group of students suing Harvard over its affirmative action policy, and why getting into a college in the first place isn't necessarily about good grades and test scores, an argument for getting rid of alumni giving and college tours, and later on, why signing credit card slips has become absurd.
We just sign people's names. We sign Justin Bieber's name, Jessica Alba, Oprah. It did not matter what we wrote. They accepted the signature. I wrote the word poop, and they said they gave me a thumbs up.
The death of the signature. All that coming up next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's fat versus small envelope time. High school seniors finding out which colleges have accepted them. Some confident that their hard work has paid off and they'll get into the school of their dreams. Well, Increasingly, that's more often a reality for wealthy kids. Despite efforts to make colleges more economically diverse, lower-income students with great grades and high SAT scores are still being shut out of top schools. And the gap between rich and poor college grads continues to grow. And that's worrisome to a former chancellor of the New York City Public Schools who, diagnosed with terminal ALS, has decided he has nothing to lose by speaking out. Harold Levy, along with author and journalist Peg Tyre, wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times yesterday that lays out steps that should be taken to make getting into college fairer. And Peg Tyre joins me now. Welcome.
Oh, nice to be here. Thanks very much.
And just to be clear, you are speaking not only for yourself, but also for Harold Levy, who can't really make media appearances right now.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. So colleges, they do make efforts to open up access to lower-income students, and they do provide scholarships. But what is it about the application process, you think, that's holding these kids back?
Well, it really starts almost in the very beginning years of schooling. You know, we have very unequal school systems. But when it comes to college, we act like it's a meritocracy. And affluent kids have college advising and application tutors and essay editors and a raft of professionals that ease their way into the college admission process. And for public school kids or kids from less affluent communities, the guidance counselor to student ratio is about 500 to 1.
Hmm.
So the process is increasingly more complicated and baroque and expensive. And at the same time, middle and low income students have fewer and fewer resources.
And how did it get that way? How did it become increasingly baroque? When did that happen?
Well, it's a good question. What we really see overall is that more people are going to college. So that's the sort of good news.
Uh-huh.
But the gap between graduates, low-income college graduates, and affluent graduates is growing. So many, many more people are applying to college and getting into college, but middle and low-income children from low-income families tend to go to schools that are poorly resourced, that don't have the courses that the kids need to graduate in 4 years, that don't have the quality faculty, and the graduation rates are very low. So often you see their trajectory is that they take on debt and they leave with no degree, which is a disaster for them. Affluent kids, even C students, get into fairly good schools where the graduation rate is very high and they have name brand diplomas. And so it becomes less about of a meritocracy and more about how much money your parents have.
Well, speaking of money, you argue that the 529 savings program, which a lot of middle class families use, it should be gotten rid of. Why?
I'm not sure we should. I'm not sure I can recommend a tax policy change. I don't really understand, and I would be cautious about making a recommendation, something I haven't really thought through 100%. But for sure, what we see is 529s are utilized by people who are, in the main, wealthy. And they use it to send their children and take a tax deduction to save money to send their children to schools that, by and large, privilege the privileged. So you do have to wonder if that's an appropriate use of a tax exemption, because in many, many states, you get a tax exemption for saving money through a 529.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how we really want to use the tax code? I think it's a really serious question. I think if you're taking a 529 deduction, state deduction, it might behoove you to make a donation to an organization that's promoting access for middle and low-income students in your community.
Right. But what about for the parents who need to save for college? I mean, it's difficult when you're in the middle. I think when you're at the very top, you can just write a check. When you're at the very bottom, there seem to be more scholarship opportunities available.
You're 100% correct about that. What you're seeing is lower middle income families are the ones who are really in a terrible bind here. And middle income families, low income students suffer in other ways in that they often attend schools where they're not academically prepared for college. So they're not really even queued up to attend a selective university. So they lose out very early on in the up higher education sweepstakes, which is in itself very sad. But by the time you get to the college application process, There are many, many access programs for low-income students, especially students in urban areas, many fewer from low-income students from rural areas, and many fewer for the lower middle-income students.
One of the rites of passage is the college tour, and you argue in your essay that that's really unfair as well, because middle-class parents can afford to go on these college tours. But I guess I didn't know that admissions officers actually weigh that as a factor when it comes to deciding who to admit.
Now, not all of them do. Some colleges have done away with what they call demonstrated interest, but many colleges talk how many times you contact the admissions office, whether you come, whether you take a tour, whether you seek an interview. And what that actually does is it clarifies for the admissions department who is affluent enough to get there. College tours have become an example of excess in spending for affluent parents, for the coastal middle class, I would say, which is what looks like middle class in California and on the East Coast, which is really affluent for the rest of the country. But it's very common to find families who are taking their sons or daughters' junior year vacation time and going all over the country looking at colleges that their child may or may not apply to. The Common App plays a role in this. The Common Application allows students to apply to 12, 15, even 20 colleges without very much effort at all. So they fire off a number of applications, and the admissions departments are trying to weed out the candidates who are actually serious and would accept their offer of admission.
Right, because it makes their numbers look better if they have more acceptances.
Right, so there's kind of a game going on, and the game continually disadvantages low-income, middle-low-income, and middle-income families.
Okay, so it sounds to me that I guess one solution would be to all of this is to have more financial aid available for students. What are some other ways, or what is one big way, I should say, to even the playing field?
That many, many low-income, low-middle-income, middle-income students are going to two-year schools. This is especially true in California, where out-of-state students have created a situation where California students are shut out of the UC system, so a four-year system. So many students are going to two-year colleges. Great students persevere despite the underfunding of their institutions, but then they find that it's very difficult to transfer into a better school as a junior. Their credits aren't accepted. The schools don't accept transfer students. The schools want to make them start as freshmen. That's ridiculous. There should be a way for all schools to take transfer students and to welcome them in large numbers, because those are going to be the low-income students and the middle-income students who are coming in academically equipped, ready and ambitious, and ready to, you know, go for a degree, but they often find that their way is blocked. So okay. I think that would be one systemic change that would really have a great impact on American society.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Peg Tyer, author of the book, The Good School, How Smart Parents Get Their Kids the Education They Deserve. Peg, thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure.
All right, on the topic of college admissions, the Justice Department might support an affirmative action lawsuit against Harvard. A nonprofit student group has sued Harvard, arguing it discriminates against Asian Americans in its admissions process. A trial date has not been set yet, but a federal judge in Boston is expected to hear arguments tomorrow over whether Harvard can keep some of its admissions records under seal, private. In a brief filed Friday, the Justice Department says that information should be made public. Jessica Levinson is here now to talk with us about that. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our Monday Legal Eagle. Hello.
Happy Monday.
All right. So catch us up to speed with this case. The student group that has filed the lawsuits, the name is Students for Fair Admissions. And what are they alleging?
And this is a student group that is led by a very famous, actually, conservative legal scholar, Edward Blum, who famously has brought a number of affirmative action cases, or we should actually say anti-affirmative action cases. And so what they're arguing is we're hurt by race-conscious admissions processes. So if you just looked at our numbers and our extracurriculars, we would be into Harvard. But because you, Harvard, also want to create something called educational diversity, for many of the reasons that you just talked about in your last segment, that actually harms us and means that we won't get in, and it harms us to the tune of it being illegal.
So they're looking to get rid of the entire affirmative action process at Harvard?
Well, I think that they're at it depends, you know, kind of how they're going to fashion their relief is not clear. But I think what they're saying is whatever you're doing now is too harmful.
And they want these documents made public. What are these documents?
So what they got in the course of this lawsuit is really a ton of documents dealing with high school applicants who have applied to Harvard and the kind of inner workings of Harvard's admissions process. And this apparently has been very useful to them. And they've said, let's bring this to light and let's show this to the world because presumably they think it will be helpful to their case. Harvard has said, no, thank you. And essentially they've used a number of different arguments. They've said it's highly proprietary or it's highly sensitive or it's private, a lot of which kind of boils down to all of these people who applied to Harvard didn't consider that they might be part of a lawsuit later on and didn't want their information to be public.
Or maybe Harvard doesn't want its admissions criteria made public.
Or maybe option C, all of the above, right?
Right. All right. So that's what's going to happen tomorrow, is a federal judge is going to hear arguments about whether or not to unseal these records?
Tomorrow is not about, is affirmative action at Harvard permissible? Is it impermissible? Tomorrow is about whether or not these documents should be public or remain under seal. And that's still a big part of the case. And I think what's particularly interesting is the Justice Department's interest in this.
Yeah, why would the Justice Department weigh in on this?
For a couple of different reasons. One is that they're investigating a 2015 complaint by a group of Asian American student associations that essentially make the same argument.
A different group
of associations. And the issue is whether or not the Department of Justice, one, may want to sue Harvard on its own, or they could join this suit as something called basically like a friend of the court. And what's particularly interesting for people watching the Justice Department is, one, this is the first big test of the Trump administration when it comes to affirmative action. And two, unsurprisingly, it's a huge shift from President Obama's policy, which was either to basically stay out of these particular fights or to say, you know what, we're going to come in on the other side, the side of the schools, and say educational diversity is something that we absolutely have to support.
Well, back in the Obama days, 2 whole years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that race can be one among many criteria for admissions. This was in a University of Texas case. So is the fact that that's a public university, does that make it different from Harvard?
Well, Harvard does accept public funds. So there's a couple of differences. I mean, one, Harvard is a public institution. Two, this is brought by an Asian American student. But the Supreme Court ruling was actually fairly broad. And that's been pretty consistent with all of the Supreme Court rulings in affirmative action, which is basically like, sure, you can consider it. And they haven't been terrific on the details, mostly because I think they can't get 5 votes to be terrific on the details. So part of the lower court actions that you see after that University of Texas case are about trying to flesh out, sure, you can consider race, but how much is too much and et cetera.
And so Harvard, is it worried that once it opens the door tomorrow, or it's forced to open the door tomorrow to opening its admissions criteria, that that will unleash a floodgate of complaints when it comes to affirmative action?
Well, I mean, if they have to open the documents and if it turns out that that is harmful to them and that it shows, that a judge comes to the decision that, yes, this is an impermissible use of race-conscious admissions process, I think that they're worried that they were going to have to change their processes and potentially that there would be more complaints. But I think their first line is, we just don't want to show you this information.
Okay, speaking of the Justice Department, Attorney General Jeff Sessions says he wants federal prosecutors in border states, including this one, California, to put more emphasis on criminally charging people caught crossing the border illegally for the first time. And so what exactly is the change here?
So the change is in many ways a change in priority. And what he's saying to the attorneys in the border states is, you need to make sure that you're putting more resources towards these prosecutions. And what he's saying is we need to treat them more seriously. And basically, we have not taken it particularly seriously, according to Jeff Sessions. If you were not someone who was, for instance, trying to smuggle illegal immigrants, or if you didn't otherwise have a criminal record, then we didn't really take, you know, we said maybe this is a misdemeanor, and we did not hold you at a deportation center while you were waiting for your hearing. This is a program called Catch and Release, which President Trump has decided to disband. And so what this is part of a much bigger narrative, one that candidate Trump started, and now President Trump has continued, which says we're going to crack down on illegal immigration. And it's no coincidence that the Trump administration is also saying, let's send 2,000 to 4,000 National Guard troops to the border.
But isn't it true that when people are caught by Border Patrol, most often they're just sent back over? They're not allowed to, you know, roam free, as President Trump would describe it. Most of them are caught and processed and then sent back over.
I don't know exactly what the percentage of that most of them is, but yes, most of them do not then remain in the country.
It's only when they're claiming asylum or fear of persecution or something like that.
Exactly. And so I think that this is about a larger narrative, most, or I should say some of which, frankly, is just based on falsehoods, that we really need to eliminate this huge uptick in illegal immigration. And so there absolutely has been a recent uptick, and that is consistent with recent seasonal upticks that we have seen for many years. But if you look at a much broader picture, these types of illegal border crossings are actually down.
Mm. Okay. And so if they did prosecute first-time border crossers, what would that even look like? Where would you house them? You'd have to hold them for months while they're awaiting trial. Where would that be?
Well, and this is in conjunction with Attorney General Jeff Sessions saying to immigration judges, you need to clear your backlogs and you need to work a lot faster. And so a lot of people are worried about, well, what is going to happen in terms of the claims of these people who are saying, you know, maybe I'm seeking asylum, and how are we going to dole out justice if the Department of Justice has also said, clear your docket? And so part of the memo that was issued by the Trump administration said to military facilities, maybe you should think about where we can house these people, because there's an understanding that the detention centers just aren't big enough. I mean, somewhat similar to our prison overcrowding system in California, which is actually so overcrowded that it's been called unconstitutionally overcrowded.
Jessica Levinson, she teaches law at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Little drop of depression for Monday.
Thank you.
Sure.
Coming up on the program, why your signature is pretty much meaningless. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You probably signed a credit card machine recently with one of those plastic pens, or maybe with your finger. Maybe you channel your inner third grader and craft a masterpiece of American handwriting when you do that. But if you're like most people, you probably just draw some squiggly lines and call it a day. Well, the signature might not be long for this world. The biggest credit card companies, Visa, American Express, for example, will not require them anymore. The CEO of Walmart calls signatures worthless. Well, Mark Melkoff is a comedian who conducted a social experiment. He went to a bunch of stores in L.A. with some interesting signatures. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, so you had this in your head that nobody really looks at signatures when they take your credit card?
It's true. I remember back in the day when they would ask for ID occasionally and they would actually line it up. But I mean, that was, it seems to me, it's 10 years ago, something like that. So we've had a decade, Madeline, where they would add that now they have you sign, but it really doesn't matter. I proved it does not matter what you write. It doesn't matter what you do, and they will accept it. So it was one of those things where I think that this new regulation is long overdue.
Yeah, just getting rid of them entirely?
I think so. I mean, Greg Benson, who's another YouTube comedian in Los Angeles, we went around to all these stores. We in Los Angeles, we went to Party City, we went to Walgreens, we went to Sports Chalet, and we just signed people's names. We signed Justin Bieber's name, Jessica Alba, Oprah. It did not matter what we wrote. They accepted the signature.
Did they even look, or did they not even see what you wrote?
They looked because we pointed it out. When I drew a picture of a banana, for example, on a purchase, they just kind of glanced and they did not hesitate. Greg Benson and I just wanted to prove and have fun that you could do anything. I really thought I would have an issue. And the only issue I did have, Madeline, is when I went back to, I believe it was Walgreens, I had to return something. And originally I drew a banana for my signature, which was fine. But when I returned, they make you do another signature on the return. And I drew the same banana, but apparently that banana did not work. And they actually had me, I had to sign a name. I forget who I did. It might have been Wendy Williams. It might have been Hoda Kotb. I forget who it was, but that
didn't
was
sign
fine.
Your name.
Oh, absolutely not. Why would I sign Mark Malkoff when, you know, you can sign Katy Perry or you can sign, you know, it doesn't really, The Weeknd, for example, and it's all good.
When was the last time you signed your real name?
Oh, gosh, it's been years since I signed my name. Normally, I sign, a line, possibly just a quick squiggly line.
But I would think your name would be really fun to sign. Two M's, two big M's. Yeah.
Occasionally, like if I do talks and somebody asks me to sign an autograph or something, I'll actually sign Mark Malkoff. But at CVS, not only, you know, if I do sign Sandra Bullock's name, not only do I kind of get a kick out of it, the people behind the counter do as well. And again, they don't care. Mm. So it brings a smile to their face. It brings a smile to my face.
Yeah. I don't know. There's something sad about it because, you know, in grade school, you would practice your signature like it was really important.
Oh, yeah. I mean, back in the day, I mean, listen, when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I collected autographs as well as like a lot of people. Like Brooke Shields was famous. She collected autographs. And the old school people, they would sign, when they would sign their name, every single letter would be visible. And I think with the more contemporary people would have heard that has got long gone. I do see older people when they are at the grocery store and then they have to sign their name, they do take their time and they write every letter down, which I just feel like for something like this where it's not necessary, it's kind of a waste of time.
I would think with your signature, you could get really fun with the M's, but also you could put like a smiley face in the O. You could
really
go nuts your name.
I think so. And Madeline seems fun as well. I mean, I definitely think the Mark and the Madeline. I think so. Yeah, I think I have a cool signature. Maybe I would. Maybe you're going to inspire me now.
Maybe that'll be your next thing. Like, see what happens when you really belabor it. Like, go to a store and spend like 2 minutes signing and making it beautiful.
Oh, my gosh. And the line in New York City. Oh, I'm sure that people in New York are going to be ever so tolerant, Madeline, when I spend 2 minutes. They're like, what are you doing? I'm going to give them your phone number, Madeline. I'm going to tell them to come to you.
It'll be our private joke. Mark Malkoff
Absolutely.
Is a comedian in New York. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, Michelle Aloy here, sitting in for the Norwegian.
Hey, Madeline.
Hi. So do you sign, because your name is Michelle Aloy, do you
right.
sign me? Did you just say me?
No, because then people get confused. They're like, I didn't sign this. Why would you write me on this? This was an ongoing thing in grade school. But I do feel really passionately about this because I think in fourth grade, I got a C in handwriting because I was told that my cursive wasn't slanted enough.
Really?
Yes. And so I feel like I obsessively cultivated a signature that I feel like is a little bit like a work of art. And I'm a little sad that it might be going wayside.
And then when you do your signature as a work of art with your finger on one of those machines,
it just doesn't, it's not the same. Like, I don't feel like I get to sort of express who I am with that finger. I mean, it's glitchy, there are scratches everywhere.
Is it important for you to express who you are when you sign?
I feel like it says a little bit about me for the better or the worse. But a lot of people had a lot of feedback on this. Most people, we did a little Twitter poll, vast majority of people say either theirs is just a squiggly line or they don't care. Some of our producers here, Sarah Sweeney, our director, says her signature is just a couple of figure eights. Yael says she came up with hers when she was 6 years old and still stuck with cheesy things that her parents told her, so now she'll never change it. Online, Patty Kumazawa said she had a college professor in the late 80s who told her to mix in some print with cursive because it made for a more impressive signature. So,
okay. All right. Well, I think it's time to, I'm going to say it.
Sign off.
Yeah, that's it. Sign off. All right. Michelle Aloy, thank you. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.